because they'd probably fire him. But he figures the day crew will think it was me untied it. I think he really does it to be kind, to help. But he makes sure he's safe first. This time he doesn't untie the sheet, but walks away from me to help two aides I never saw before and a young doctor lift old Blastic onto the stretcher and carry him out, covered with a sheet, handle him more careful than anybody ever handled him before in all his life. Come morning, McMurphy is up before I am. The first time anybody been up before me since Uncle Jules the Wall Walker was here. Jules was a shrewd old white-haired Negro with a theory the world was being tipped over on its side during the night by the black boys. He used to slip out in the early mornings aiming to catch them tipping it. Like Jules, I'm up early in the mornings to watch what machinery they're sneaking onto the ward or installing in the shaving room. And usually it's just me and the black boys in the hall for 15 minutes before the next patient is out of bed. But this morning I hear McMurphy out there in the latrine as I come out of the covers. Hear him singing. Singing so you'd think he didn't have a worry in the world. His voice is clear and strong, slapping up against the cement and steel. Your horses are hungry, that's what she did say. He's enjoying the way the sound rings in the latrine. Come sit down beside me and feed them some hay. He gets a breath and his voice jumps a key, gaining pitch and power till it's joggling the wiring in all the walls. My horses ain't hungry, they won't eat your hay. He holds the note and plays with it, then swoops down with the rest of the verse to finish it off. So fare thee well, darling, I'm gone on my way. Singing. Everybody's thunderstruck. They haven't heard such a thing in years. Not on this ward. Most of the acutes in the dorm are up on their elbows, blinking and listening. They look at one another and raise their eyebrows. How come the black boys haven't hushed them up out there? They never let anybody raise that much racket before, did they? How come they treat this new guy different? He's a man made out of skin and bone that's due to get weak and pale and die just like the rest of us. He lives under the same laws, gotta eat, bumps up against the same troubles. These things make him just as vulnerable to the Combine as anybody else, don't they? But the new guy is different, and the acutes can see it. Different from anybody been coming on this ward for the past 10 years, different from anybody they ever met outside. He's just as vulnerable, maybe, but the Combine didn't get him. My wagons are loaded, he sings. My whip's in my hand. How'd he manage to slip the collar? Maybe, like old Pete, the Combine missed getting to him soon enough with controls. Maybe he growed up so wild all over the country, batting around from one place to another, never around one town longer than a few months when he was a kid, so a school never got much a hold on him. Logging, gambling, running carnival wheels, traveling light-footed and fast, keeping on the move so much that the Combine never had a chance to get anything installed. Maybe that's it. He never gave the Combine a chance. Just like he never gave the black boy a chance to get to him with the thermometer yesterday morning, because a moving target is hard to hit. No wife wanting new linoleum. No relatives pulling at him with watery old eyes. No one to care about, which is what makes him free enough to be a good con man. And maybe the reason the black boys don't rush into that latrine and put a stop to his singing is because they know he's out of control, and they remember that time with old Pete and what a man out of control can do. And they can see that McMurphy's a lot bigger than old Pete. If it comes down to getting the best of him, it's going to take all three of them and the big nurse waiting on the sidelines with a needle. The acutes nod at one another. That's the reason they figure that the black boys haven't stopped his singing where they would stop any of the rest of us. I come out of the dorm into the hall just as McMurphy comes out of the latrine. He's got his cap on and not much else, just a towel grabbed around his hips. He's holding a toothbrush in his other hand. He stands in the hall looking up and down, rocking up on his toes to keep off the cold tile as much as he can. Picks him out a black boy, the least one, and walks up to him and whaps him on the shoulder, just like they'd been friends all their lives. Hey there, old buddy, what's my chance of getting some toothpaste for brushing my grinders? The black boy's dwarf head swivels and comes nose to knuckle with that hand. He frowns at it, then takes a quick check where's the other two black boys just in case, and tells McMurphy they don't open the cabinet till 6:45.
It's a policy, he says.
Is that right? I mean, is that where they keep the toothpaste in the cabinet?
That's right, locked in the cabinet.
The black boy tries to go back to polishing the baseboards, but that hand is still lopped over his shoulder like a big red clamp.
Locked in the cabinet, is it? Well, well, well. Now, why do you reckon they keep the toothpaste locked up? I mean, it ain't like it's dangerous, is it? You can't poison a man with it, can you? You can't brain some guy with the tube, could you?
What reason you suppose they have for putting something as harmless as a little tube of toothpaste under lock and key?
It's ward policy, Mr. McMurphy. That's a reason.
And when he sees that this last reason don't affect McMurphy like it should, he frowns at that hand on his shoulder and adds,
What you suppose it'd be like if everybody was to brush their teeth whenever they took a notion to brush?
McMurphy turns loose the shoulder, tugs at that tuft of red wool at his neck, and thinks this over.
I think I can see what you're driving at. Ward policy is for those that can't brush after every meal.
My God, don't you see?
Yes, now I do. You're saying people be brushing their teeth whenever the spirit moved them.
That's right. That's why we...
And Lordy, can you imagine teeth being brushed at 6:30, 6:20? Who can tell? Maybe even 6 o'clock. Yeah, I can see your point. He winks past the black boy at me standing against the wall.
I gotta get this baseball clean, McMurphy.
Oh, I didn't mean to keep you from your job.
He starts to back away as the black boy bends to his work again. Then he comes forward and leans over to look in the can at the black boy's side.
Well, look here. What do we have here?
The black boy peers down.
Look where?
Look here in this old can, Sam.
What is this stuff in this old can?
That's soap powder.
Well, I generally use paste, but...
McMurphy runs his toothbrush down in the powder and swishes it around and pulls it out and taps it on the side of the can.
But this'll do fine for me. I thank you. We'll look into that ward policy business later.
And he heads back to the latrine, where I can hear his singing garbled by the piston beat of his toothbrushing. That black boy standing there looking after him with his scrub rag hanging limp in his gray hand. After a minute, he blinks and looks around and sees I've been watching, and comes over and drags me down the hall by the drawstring on my pajamas and pushes me to a place on the floor I just did yesterday.
There, damn you, right there! That's why I want you working, not gawking around like some big useless cow! There, there!
And I lean over and go to mopping with my back to him so he won't see me grin. I feel good, seeing McMurphy get that black boy's goat like not many men could. Papa used to be able to do it. Spraddle-legged, dead-panned. Squinting up at the sky that first time the government men showed up to negotiate about buying off the treaty.
Canada honkers up there, Papa says, squinting up.
Government men look, rattling papers.
What are you, in July? There's no, geese this time of year, no geese.
They had been talking like tourists from the East, who figure you've got to talk to Indians so they'll understand. Papa didn't seem to take any notice of the way they talked. He kept looking at the sky.
Geese up there, white man. You know it. Geese this year. And last year. And the year before. And the year before.
The men looked at one another and cleared their throats.
Yes, maybe true, Chief Bromden. Now, forget geese. Pay attention to contract. What we offer could greatly benefit you, your people. Change the lives of the red man.
Papa said.
And the year before, and the year before, and the year before.
By the time it dawned on the government men that they were being poked fun at, all the council who'd been sitting on the porch of our shack, putting pipes in the pockets of their red and black plaid wool shirts and taking them back out again, grinning at one another and at Papa, they had all busted up laughing fit to kill. Uncle R.N.J. Wolf was rolling on the ground, gasping with laughter and saying,
You know it, white man!
It sure did get their goat.
They turned without saying a word and walked off toward the highway, red-necked, us laughing behind them. I forget sometimes what laughter can do. The big nurse's key hits the lock, and the black boy is up to her as soon as she's in the door, shifting from foot to foot like a kid asking to pee. I'm close enough to hear McMurphy's name come into his conversation a couple of times, so I know he's telling her about McMurphy brushing his teeth. Completely forgetting to tell her about the old vegetable who died during the night. waving his arms and trying to tell her what that fool redhead's been up to already so early in the morning, disrupting things, going contrary to ward policy. Can't she do something? She glares at the black boy till he stops fidgeting, then looks up the hall to where McMurphy's singing is booming out of the latrine door louder than ever.
Oh, your parents don't like me. They say I'm too poor. They say I'm not worthy to enter your door.
Her face is puzzled at first, like the rest of us. It's been so long since she's heard singing, it takes her a second to recognize what it is.
Hard living's my pleasure, my money's my own, and them that don't like me can leave me alone.
She listens a minute more to make sure she isn't hearing things. Then she goes to puffing up. Her nostrils flare open, and every breath she draws gets bigger, as big and tough-looking as I've seen her get over a patient since Tabor was here. She works the hinges in her elbows and fingers. I hear a small squeak. She starts moving, and I get back against the wall. And when she rumbles past, she's already big as a truck, trailing that wicker bag behind in her exhaust like a semi behind a Jimmy Diesel. Her lips are parted, and her smile's going out before her like a radiator grill. I can smell the hot oil and magneto spark when she goes past, and every step hits the floor she blows up a size bigger, blowing and puffing, roll down anything in her path. I'm scared to think what she'll do. Then, just as she's rolling along at her biggest and meanest, McMurphy steps out of the latrine door right in front of her, holding that towel around his hips, stops her dead. She shrinks to about head high to where that towel covers him, and he's grinning down on her. Her own grin is giving way, sagging at the edges.
Good morning, Miss Ratshed. How's things on the outside?
You can't run around here in a towel.
No?
He looks down at the part of the towel she's eye to eye with, and it's wet and skin tight.
Towels against ward policy, too? Well, I guess there's nothing to do except...
Stop. Don't you dare. You get back in that dorm and get your clothes on this instant. She sounds like a teacher bawling out a student, so McMurphy hangs his head like a student and says in a voice sounds like he's about to cry,
I can't do that, ma'am. I'm afraid some thief in the night boosted my clothes whilst I slept. I sleep awful sound on the mattresses you have here.
Somebody boosted?
Pinched, jobbed, swiped, stole,
he says happily.
You know, man, like somebody boosted my threads.
Saying this tickles him so he goes into a little barefooted dance before her.
Stole your clothes? That looks like the whole of it.
But prison clothes?
Why?
He stops jigging around and hangs his head again.
All I know is that they were there when I went to bed and gone when I got up. Gone slick as a whistle. Oh, I do know they were nothing but prison clothes, coarse and faded and uncouth, ma'am. Well, I know it. And prison clothes may not seem like much to those who has more. But to a nude man?
That outfit, she says, realizing, was supposed to be picked up. You were issued a uniform of green convalescence this morning. He shakes his head and sighs, but still don't look up.
No? No, I'm afraid I wasn't. Not a thing this morning but the cap that's on my head and Williams.
She hollers down to the black boy who's still at the ward door like he might make a run for it.
Williams, can you come here a moment?
He crawls to her like a dog to a whipping. Williams, why doesn't this patient have an issue of convalescence? The black boy's relieved. He straightens up and grins, raises that gray hand and points down the other end of the hall to one of the big ones.
Mr. Washington over there assigned to the laundry duty this morning, not me, no.
Mr. Washington. She nails him with his mop poised over the bucket, freezes him there. Will you come here a moment? The mop slides without a sound back in the bucket, and with slow, careful movements, he leans the handle against the wall. He turns around and looks down at McMurphy and the least black boy and the nurse. He looks then to his left and to his right, like she might be yelling at someone else.
Come down here!
He puts his hands in his pockets and starts shuffling down the hall to her. He never walks very fast, and I can see how if he don't get a move on, she might freeze him and shatter him all to hell just by looking. All the hate and fury and frustration she was planning to use on McMurphy is beaming out down the hall at the black boy, and he can feel it blast against him like a blizzard wind, slowing him more than ever. He has to lean into it, pulling his arms around him. Frost forms in his hair and eyebrows. He leans farther forward, but his steps are getting slower. He'll never make it. Then McMurphy takes to whistling Sweet Georgia Brown, and the nurse looks away from the black boy just in time. Now she's madder and more frustrated than ever. Madder than I ever saw her get. Her doll smile is gone, stretched tight and thin as a red-hot wire. If some of the patients could be out to see her now, McMurphy could start collecting his bets. The black boy finally gets to her, and it took him 2 hours. She draws a long breath. Washington. Why wasn't this man issued a change of greens this morning? Couldn't you see he had nothing on but a towel? And my cap, McMurphy whispers, tapping the brim with his finger. Mr. Washington. The big black boy looks at the little one who pointed him out, and the little black boy commences to fidget again. The big boy looks at him a long time with those radio tube eyes, plans to square things with him later. Then the head turns, and he looks McMurphy up and down, taking in the hard, heavy shoulders, the lopsided grin, the scar on the nose, the hand clamping the towel in place, and then he looks at the nurse.
I guess, he starts out.
You guess! You'll do more than guess. You'll get him a uniform this instant, Mr. Washington, or spend the next 2 weeks working on geriatrics ward.
Yes. You may need a month of bedpans and slab baths to refresh your appreciation of just how little work you aides have to do on this ward. If this was one of the other wards, who do you think would be scouring the hall all day?
Mr. Bromden here?
No, you know who it would be. We excuse you aides from most of your housekeeping duties to enable you to see to the patients, and that means seeing that they don't parade around exposed. What do you think would have happened if one of the young nurses had come in early and found a patient running around the halls without a uniform? What do you think?
The big black boy isn't too sure what, but he gets her drift and ambles off to the linen room to get McMurphy a set of greens, probably 10 sizes too small, and ambles back and holds it out to him with a look of the clearest hate I ever saw. McMurphy just looks confused, like he don't know how to take the outfit the black boy's handing to him, what with one hand holding the toothbrush and the other hand holding up the towel. He finally winks at the nurse and shrugs and unwraps the towel, drapes it over her shoulder like she was a wooden rack. I see he had his shorts on under the towel all along. I think for a fact she'd rather he'd have been stark naked under that towel than had on those shorts. She's glaring at those big white whales leaping around on his shorts in pure wordless outrage. That's more than she can take. It's a full minute before she can pull herself together enough to turn on the least black boy, her voice shaking out of control, she's so mad.
Williams, I believe you were supposed to have the windows of the nurse's station polished by the time I arrived this morning.
He scuttles off like a black and white bug.
And you, Washington? And you?
Washington shuffles back to his bucket in almost a trot. She looks around again, wondering who else she can light into. She spots me, but by this time some of the other patients are out of the dorm and wondering about the little clutch of us here in the hall. She closes her eyes and concentrates. She can't have them see her face like this, white and warped with fury. She uses all the power of control that's in her. Gradually, the lips gather together again under the little white nose, run together, like the red-hot wire had got hot enough to melt, shimmer a second, then click solid as the molten metal sets, growing cold and strangely dull. Her lips part, and her tongue comes between them, a chunk of slag. Her eyes open again, and they have that strange dull and cold and flat look the lips have, but she goes into her good morning routine like there was nothing different about her, figuring the patients will be too sleepy to notice.
Good morning, Mr. Seafelt. Are your teeth any better?
Good morning, Mr. Fredrickson.
Did you and Mr. Seafelt have a good night last night? You bed right next to each other, don't you? Incidentally, it's been brought to my attention that you two have made some arrangement with your medication. You are letting Bruce have your medication, aren't you, Mr. Seafelt?
We'll discuss that later.
Good morning, Billy. I saw your mother on the way in. and she told me to be sure to tell you she thought of you all the time and knew you wouldn't disappoint her. Good morning, Mr. Harding. Why, look, your fingertips are red and raw. Have you been chewing your fingernails again? Before they could answer, even if there was some answer to make, she turns to McMurphy still standing there in his shorts. Harding looks at the shorts and whistles. And you, Mr. McMurphy, she says, smiling, sweet as sugar. If you are finished showing off your manly physique and your gaudy underpants, I think you'd better go back in the dorm and put on your greens. He tips his cap to her and to the patients ogling and poking fun at his white whale shorts, and goes to the dorm without a word. She turns and starts off in the other direction, her flat smile going out before her. Before she's got the door closed on her glass station, his singing is rolling from the dorm door into the hall again. She took me to her parlor and cooled me with her fan. I can hear the whack as he slaps his bare belly. Whispered low in her mama's ear, I love that gambling man. Sweeping the dorm soon as it's empty, I'm after dust mice under his bed when I get a smell of something that makes me realize, for the first time since I've been in the hospital, that this big dorm full of beds sleeps 40 grown men, has always been sticky with 1,000 other smells. Smells of germicide, zinc ointment and foot powder, smell of piss and sour old man manure, of pablum and eyewash, of musty shorts and socks, musty even when they're fresh back from the laundry, the stiff odor of starch in the linen, the acid stench of morning mouths, the banana smell of machine oil, and sometimes the smell of singed hair. But never before now, before he came in, the man smell of dust and dirt from the open fields and sweat and work. All through breakfast, McMurphy's talking and laughing a mile a minute. After this morning, he thinks the big nurse is going to be a snap. He don't know he just caught her off guard and, if anything, made her strengthen herself. He's being the clown, working at getting some of the guys to laugh. It bothers him that the best they can do is grin weakly and snigger sometimes. He prods at Billy Bibbit, sitting across the table from him, says in a secret voice, "Hey, Billy boy, you remember that time in Seattle you and me picked up those two twitches? One of the best rolls I ever had." Billy's eyes bob up from his plate. He opens his mouth but can't say a thing. McMurphy turns to Harding. "We'd have never brought it off, neither, picking them up on the spur of the moment that way, except that they'd heard tell of Billy Bibbit. Billy Club Bibbit, he was known as in them days. Those girls were about to take off when one of them looked at him and says, 'Are you the renowned Billy Club Bibbit of the famous 14 inches?' And Billy ducked his head and blushed, like he's doing now, and we were a-shoo-in. And I remember when we got them up to the hotel, there was this woman's voice from over near Billy's bed says, 'Mr. Bibbit, I'm disappointed in you. I heard that you had for goodness sakes!' And whoops and slaps his leg and gooses Billy with his thumb till I think Billy will fall in a dead faint from blushing and grinning. McMurphy says that, as a matter of fact, a couple of sweet twitches like those two is the only thing this hospital does lack. The bed they give a man here, finest he's ever slept in, and what a fine table they do spread. He can't figure why everybody's so glum about being locked up here. 'Look at me now,' he tells the guys and lifts a glass to the light. 'Getting my first glass of orange juice in 6 months. Hoo-wee, that's good. I ask you, what did I get for breakfast at that work farm? What was I served? Well, I can describe what it looked like, but I sure couldn't hang a name on it. Morning, noon, and night, it was burnt black and had potatoes in it and looked like roofing glue. I know one thing, it wasn't orange juice. Look at me now, bacon, toast, butter, eggs, coffee. The little honey in the kitchen even asked me if I like it black or white, thank you, and a great big cold glass of orange juice. Why, you couldn't pay me to leave this place.' He gets seconds on everything and makes a date with the girl pours coffee in the kitchen for when he gets discharged, and he compliments the Negro cook on Sunny setting the best eggs he ever ate. There's bananas for the cornflakes, and he gets a handful, tells the black boy he'll filch him one 'cause he looks so starved, and the black boy shifts his eyes to look down the hall
to where the nurse is sitting in her glass case and says it ain't allowed for the help to eat with the patients.
Against ward policy?
That's right.
Tough luck.
And peels three bananas right under the black boy's nose and eats one after the other. Tells the boy that any time you want one snuck out of the mess hall for you, Sam, you just give the word. When McMurphy finishes his last banana, he slaps his belly and gets up and heads for the door. And the big black boy blocks the door and tells him the rule that patients sit in the mess hall till they all leave at 7:30. McMurphy stares at him like he can't believe he's hearing right, then turns and looks at Harding. Harding nods his head. So McMurphy shrugs and goes back to his chair.
I sure don't want to go against that goddamn policy.
The clock at the end of the mess hall shows it's 7:15. Lies about how we only been sitting here 15 minutes when you can tell it's been at least an hour. Everybody has finished eating and leaned back, watching the big hand to move to 7:30. The black boys take away the vegetable-splattered trays and wheel the two old men down to get hosed off. In the mess hall, about half the guys lay their heads on their arms, figuring to get a little sleep before the black boys get back. There's nothing else to do, with no cards or magazines or picture puzzles. Just sleep or watch the clock. But McMurphy can't keep still for that. He's got to be up to something. After about 2 minutes of pushing food scraps around his plate with his spoon, he's ready for more excitement. He hooks his thumbs in his pockets and tips back and one-eyes that clock up on the wall. Then he rubs his nose.
You know, that old clock up there puts me in mind of the targets at the target range at Fort Riley. That's where I got my first medal, a sharpshooter medal. Deadeye Murphy. Who wants to lay me a poor little dollar that I can't put this dab of butter square in the center of the face of that clock up there, or at least on the face?
He gets three bets and takes up his butter pat and puts it on his knife, gives it a flip. It sticks a good 6 inches or so to the left of the clock, and everybody kids him about it until he pays his bets. They're still riding him about did he mean dead eye or dead eyes when the least black boy gets back from hosing vegetables and everybody looks into his plate and keeps quiet. The black boy senses something is in the air, but he can't see what. And he probably never would have known except old Colonel Matterson is gazing around, and he sees the butter stuck up on the wall, and this causes him to point up at it and go into one of his lessons, explaining to us all in his patient, rumbling voice, just like what he said made sense.
The butter is the Republican Party.
The black boy looks where the colonel is pointing, and there that butter is, easing down the wall like a yellow snail. He blinks at it, but he doesn't say a word, doesn't even bother looking around to make certain who flipped it up there. McMurphy is whispering and nudging the acute sitting around him, and in a minute they all nod, and he lays $3 on the table and leans back. Everybody turns in his chair and watches that butter sneak on down the wall, starting, hanging still, shooting ahead, and leaving a shiny trail behind it on the paint. Nobody says a word. They look at the butter, then at the clock, then back at the butter. The clock's moving now. The butter makes it down to the floor about half a minute before 7:30, and McMurphy gets back all the money he lost. The black boy wakes up and turns away from the greasy stripe in the wall and says we can go, and McMurphy walks out of the mess hall, folding his money in his pocket. He puts his arms around the black boy's shoulder and half walks, half carries him down the hall toward the day room.
The day's half gone, Sam, old buddy, and I'm just barely breaking even. I'll have to hustle to catch up. How about breaking out that deck of cards you got locked securely in that cabinet, and I'll see if I can make myself heard over that loudspeaker.
Spends most of that morning hustling to catch up by dealing more blackjack, playing for IOUs now instead of cigarettes. He moves the blackjack table two or three times to try to get out from under the speaker. You can tell it's getting on his nerves. Finally, he goes to the nurse's station and raps on a pane of glass till the big nurse swivels in her chair and opens the door, and he asks her about turning that infernal noise off for a while. She's calmer than ever now, back in her seat behind her pane of glass. There's no heathen running around half-naked to unbalance her. Her smile is settled and solid. She closes her eyes and shakes her head and tells McMurphy very pleasantly, no.
Can't you even ease down on the volume? It ain't like the whole state of Oregon needed to hear Lawrence Welk play T for two, three times every hour all day long.
If it was soft enough to hear a man shout his bets across the table, I might get a game of poker going.
You've been told, Mr. McMurphy, that it's against the policy to gamble for money on the ward.
Okay, then down soft enough to gamble for matches, for fly buttons. Just turn the damn thing down.
Mr. McMurphy. She waits and lets her calm schoolteacher tone sink in before she goes on. She knows every acute on the ward is listening to them. Do you want to know what I think? I think you are being very selfish. Haven't you noticed there are others in this hospital besides yourself? There are old men here who couldn't hear the radio at all if it were lower, old fellows who simply aren't capable of reading or working puzzles or playing cards to win other men's cigarettes. Old fellows like Madison and Kitling. That music coming from the loudspeaker is all they have. And you want to take that away from them. We like to hear suggestions and requests whenever we can, but I should think you might at least give some thought to others before you make your requests. He turns and looks over at the chronic side and sees there's something to what she says. He takes off his cap and runs his hand in his hair, finally turns back to her. He knows as well as she does that all the acutes are listening to everything they say.
Okay. I never thought about that.
I thought you hadn't. He tugs at that little tuft of red showing out of the neck of his greens, then says,
Well, hey, what do you say to us taking the card game someplace else? Some other room. Like, say, that room you people put the tables in during that meeting. There's nothing in there all the rest of the day. You could unlock that room and let the card players go in there and leave the old men out here with their radio. A good deal all around.
She smiles and closes her eyes again and shakes her head gently. Of course, you may take the suggestion up with the rest of the staff at some time, but I'm afraid everyone's feelings will correspond with mine. We do not have adequate coverage for 2-day rooms. There isn't enough personnel. And I wish you wouldn't lean against the glass there, please. Your hands are oily and staining the window. That means extra work for some of the other men. He jerks his hand away, and I see he starts to say something and then stops, realizing she didn't leave him anything else to say unless he wants to start cussing at her. His face and neck are red. He draws a long breath and concentrates on his willpower the way she did this morning, and tells her that he is very sorry to have bothered her and goes back to the card table. Everybody on the ward can feel that it started. At 11 o'clock, the doctor comes to the day room door and calls over to McMurphy that he'd like to have him come down to his office for an interview. I interview all new admissions on the second day. McMurphy lays down his cards and stands up and walks over to the doctor. The doctor asks him how his night was, but McMurphy just mumbles an answer.
You look deep in thought today, Mr. McMurphy.
Oh, I'm a thinker, all right, McMurphy says, and they walk off together down the hall.
When they come back what seems like days later, they're both grinning and talking and happy about something. The doctor is wiping tears off his glasses and looks like he's actually been laughing, and McMurphy is back as loud and full of brass and swagger as ever. He's that way all through lunch. And at 1 o'clock, he's the first one in his seat for the meeting, his eyes blue and ornery from his place in the corner. The big nurse comes into the day room with her covey of student nurses and her basket of notes. She picks the logbook up from the table and frowns into it a minute. Nobody's informed on anybody all day long. Then goes to her seat beside the door. She picks up the folders from the basket on her lap and riffles through them till she finds the one on Harding. As I recall, we were making quite a bit of headway yesterday with Mr. Harding's problem.
Before we go into that, the doctor says, I'd like to interrupt a moment, if I might, concerning a talk Mr. McMurphy and I had in my office this morning, reminiscing, actually, talking over old times. You see, Mr. McMurphy and I find we have something in common. We went to the same high school.
The nurses look at one another and wonder what's got into this man. The patients glance at McMurphy, grinning from his corner, and wait for the doctor to go on. He nods his head.
Yes, the same high school. And in the course of our reminiscing, we happened to bring up the carnivals the school used to sponsor. Marvelous, noisy gala occasions, decorations, crepe streamers, booths, games. It was always one of the prime events of the year. As I mentioned to McMurphy, was the chairman of the high school carnival, both my junior and senior year. Wonderful carefree years.
It's got real quiet in the day room. The doctor raises his head,
peers around to see if he's making a fool of himself. The big nurse is giving him a look that shouldn't leave any doubts about it, but he doesn't have on his glasses, and the look misses him.
Anyway, to put an end to this maudlin display of nostalgia, in the course of our conversation, McMurphy and I wondered, what would be the attitude of some of the men toward a carnival here on the ward?
He puts on his glasses and peers around again. Nobody's jumping up and down at the idea. Some of us can remember Tabor trying to engineer a carnival a few years back and what happened to it. As the doctor waits, a silence rears up from out of the nurse and looms over everybody, daring anybody to challenge it. I know McMurphy can't because he was in on the planning of the carnival, and just as I'm thinking that nobody will be fool enough to break that silence, Cheswick, who sits right next to McMurphy, gives a grunt and is on his feet, rubbing his ribs, before he knows what happened.
I personally believe, see...
He looks down at McMurphy's fist on the chair arm beside him, with that big stiff thumb sticking straight up out of it like a cow prod.
That a carnival is a real good idea. Something to break the monotony.
That's right, Charlie, the doctor says, appreciating Cheswick's support, and not altogether without therapeutic value.
Certainly not,
Cheswick says, looking happier now.
No, lots of therapeutics in a carnival, you bet.
It would be fun, Billy Bibbit says.
Yeah, that too,
Cheswick says.
We could do it, Dr. Spivey, sure we could. Scanlan can do his human bomb act, and I can make a ring toss in occupational therapy.
I'll tell fortunes, Martini says, and squints at a spot above his head.
I'm rather good at diagnosing pathologies from palm reading myself, Harding says.
Good, good,
Cheswick says, and claps his hands. He's never had anybody support anything he said before.
Myself, McMurphy drawls, I'd be honored to work a skillo wheel. Had a little experience.
Oh, there are numerous possibilities, the doctor says, sitting up straight in his chair and really warming to it. Why, I've got a million ideas.
He talks full steam ahead for another 5 minutes. You can tell a lot of the ideas are ideas he's already talked over with McMurphy. He describes games, booths, talks of selling tickets, then stops suddenly, as though the nurse's look had hit him right between the eyes. He blinks at her and asks,
"What do you think of the idea, Miss Ratchet, of a carnival here on the ward?"
"I agree that it may have a number of therapeutic possibilities," she says, and waits. She lets that silence rear up from her again. When she's sure nobody's going to challenge it, she goes on, "But I also believe that an idea like this should be discussed in staff meeting before a decision is reached."
"Wasn't that your idea, Doctor?"
"Of course. I merely thought, understand, I would feel out some of the men first, but certainly a staff meeting first. Then we'll continue our plans."
Everybody knows that's all there is to the carnival. The big nurse starts to bring things back into hand by rattling the folio she's holding.
"Fine. Then if there's no other new business, and if Mr. Cheswick will be seated, I think we might go right into the discussion. We have,"
she takes her watch from the basket and looks at it, 48 minutes left. So, as I...
Oh, hey, wait. I remember there is some other new business.
McMurphy has his hand up, fingers snapping. She looks at the hand for a long time before she says anything.
"Yes, Mr. McMurphy?"
"Not me. Dr. Spivey has. Doc, tell him what you come up with about the hard of hearing guys in the radio."
The nurse's head gives one little jerk, barely enough to see, but my heart is suddenly roaring. She puts the folio back in the basket, turns to the doctor.
"Yes," says the doctor. "I very nearly forgot."
He leans back and crosses his legs and puts his fingertips together. I can see he's still in good spirits about his carnival.
"You see, McMurphy and I were talking about that age-old problem we have on this ward, the mixed population, the young and the old together. It's not the most ideal surroundings for our therapeutic community, but administration says there's no helping it with the geriatric building overloaded the way it is. I'll be the first to admit it's not an absolutely pleasant situation for anyone concerned. In our talk, however, McMurphy and I did happen to come up with an idea which might make things more pleasant for both age groups. McMurphy mentioned that he had noticed some of the old fellows seemed to have difficulty hearing the radio. He suggested the speaker might be turned up louder so the chronics with auditory weaknesses could hear it. A very humane suggestion, I think."
McMurphy gives a modest wave of his hand, and the doctor nods at him and goes on.
But I told him I had received previous complaints from some of the younger men that the radio is already so loud it hinders conversation and reading. McMurphy said he hadn't thought of this, but mentioned that it did seem a shame that those who wished to read couldn't get off by themselves where it was quiet and leave the radio for those who wished to listen. I agreed with him, and that did seem a shame, and was ready to drop the matter when I happened to think of the old tub room, where we store the tables during the ward meeting. We don't use the room at all otherwise. There's no longer a need for the hydrotherapy it was designed for now that we have the new drugs. So how would the group like to have that room as a sort of second day room, a game room, shall we say?
The group isn't saying. They know whose play it is next. She folds Harding's folio back up and puts it on her lap and crosses her hands over it, looking around the room just like somebody might dare have something to say. When it's clear nobody's going to talk till she does, her head turns again to the doctor.
It sounds like a fine plan, Dr. Spivey, and I appreciate Mr. McMurphy's interest in the other patients, but I'm terribly afraid we don't have the personnel to cover a second day room,
and is so certain that this should be the end of it, she starts to open the folio again. But the doctor has thought this through more than she figured.
I thought of that too, Miss Ratchet, but since it will be largely the chronic patients who remain here in the day room with the speaker, most of whom are restricted to lounges or wheelchairs, one aide and one nurse in here should easily be able to put down any riots or uprisings that might occur, don't you think?
She doesn't answer, and she doesn't much care for his joking about riots and uprisings either, but her face doesn't change. The smile stays.
So the other two aides and nurses can cover the men in the tub room perhaps even better than here in a larger area. What do you think, men? Is it a workable idea? I'm rather enthused about it myself, and I say we give it a try, see what it's like for a few days. If it doesn't work, well, we've still got the key to lock it back up, haven't we?
Right,
Cheswick says, socks his fist into his palm. He's still standing like he's afraid to get near that thumb at McMurphy's again.
Right, Dr. Spivey, if it don't work, we still got that key to lock it back up, you bet.
The doctor looks around the room and sees all the other acutes nodding and smiling and looking so pleased with what he takes to be him and his idea that he blushes like Billy Bibbit and has to polish his glasses a time or two before he can go on. It tickles me to see the little man so happy with himself. He looks at all the guys nodding and nods himself and says,
"Fine, fine,"
and settles his hands on his knees.
"Very good. Now, if that's decided, I seem to have forgotten what we were planning to talk about this morning."
The nurse's head gives it one little jerk again, and she bends over her basket, picks up a folio. She fumbles with the papers, and it looks like her hands are shaking. She draws out a paper, but once more, before she can start reading out of it, McMurphy is standing and holding up his hand and shifting from foot to foot, giving a long, thoughtful,
"Say,"
and her fumbling stops, freezes as though the sound of his voice just froze her, like her voice froze that black boy this morning. I get that giddy feeling inside me again when she freezes. I watch her close while McMurphy talks.
"Say, doctor, what I've been dying to know is, what did this dream I dreamt the other night mean? You see, it was like I was me in the dream, and then again kind of like I wasn't me, like I was somebody else that looked like me, like my daddy. Yeah, that's who it was. It was my daddy, because sometimes when I saw him, I saw there was this iron bolt through the jawbone like daddy used to have."
"Your father has an iron bolt through his jawbone?"
"Well, not anymore, but he did once when I was a kid. He went around for about 10 months with this big metal bolt going in here and coming out here. God, he was a regular Frankenstein. He'd been clipped on the jaw with a pole axe when he got into some kind of hassle with this pond man at the logging mill. Hey, let me tell you how that incident came about."
Her face is still calm, as though she had a cast made and painted to look just the way she wants. Confident, patient, and unruffled. No more little jerk, just that terrible cold face, a calm smile stamped out of red plastic, a clean, smooth forehead, not a line in it to show weakness or worry, flat, wide, painted on green eyes, painted on with an expression that says, "I can wait. I might lose a yard now and then, but I can wait and be patient and calm and confident because I know there's no real losing for me." I thought for a minute there I saw her whipped. Maybe I did. But I see now that it don't make any difference. One by one, the patients are sneaking looks at her to see how she's taking the way McMurphy is dominating the meeting, and they see the same thing. She's too big to be beaten. She covers one whole side of the room like a Jap statue. There's no moving her and no help against her. She's lost a little battle here today, but it's a minor battle in a big war that she's been winning, and that she'll go on winning. We mustn't let McMurphy get her hopes up any different, lure us into making some kind of dumb play. She'll go on winning, just like the Combine, because she has all the power of the Combine behind her. She don't lose on her losses, but she wins on ours. To beat her, you don't have to whip her 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5, but every time you meet. As soon as you let down your guard, as soon as you lose once, she's won for good. And eventually we all got to lose. Nobody can help that. Right now she's got the fog machine switched on, and it's rolling in so fast I can't see a thing but her face, rolling in thicker and thicker, and I feel as hopeless and dead as I felt happy a minute ago when she gave that little jerk. Even more hopeless than ever before, on account of I know now there is no real help against her or the Combine. McMurphy can't help any more than I could. Nobody can help. And the more I think about how nothing can be helped, the faster the fog rolls in. And I'm glad when it gets thick enough you're lost in it and can let go and be safe again. There's a Monopoly game going on in the day room. They've been at it for 3 days, houses and hotels everywhere. 2 tables pushed together to take care of all the deeds and stacks of play money. McMurphy talked them into making the game more interesting by paying a penny for every play dollar the bank issues them. The Monopoly box is loaded with change.
It's your roll, Cheswick. Hold it a minute before he rolls. What's a man need to buy them hotels? You need 4 houses on every lot of the same color, Martini. Now let's go, for Christ's sakes. Hold it a minute.
There's a flurry of money from that side of the table, red and green and yellow bills blowing in every direction.
You're buying a hotel, you're playing Happy New Year, for Christ's sakes. It's your dirty roll, Cheswick.
Snake eyes. Hoo-wee, Cheswick. Where does that put you? That don't put you on my Marvin Gardens by any chance. That don't mean you have to pay me, let's see, $350?
Boogered. What's them other things? Hold on a minute. What's them other things all over the board?
Martini, you've been seeing them other things all over the board for 2 days. No wonder I'm losing my ass. McMurphy, I don't see how you can concentrate with Martini sitting there hallucinating a mile a minute.
Cheswick, you never mind about Martini. He's doing real good. You just come on with that $350 and Martini will take care of himself. Don't we get rent from him every time one of his things lands on our property?
Hold on a minute. There's so many of them.
That's okay, Mart. You just keep us posted whose property they land on. You're still the man with the dice, Cheswick. You rolled the double, so you roll again.
Attaboy. 4, big 6.
Takes me to chance. You have been elected chairman of the board. Pay every player boogered and double boogered. Whose hotel is this here, for Christ's sakes, on the Reading Railroad?
My friend, that, as anyone can see, is not a hotel. It's a depot.
Now hold it a minute.
McMurphy surrounds his end of the table, moving cards, rearranging money, evening up his hotels. There's $100 bill sticking out of the brim of his cap like a press card. Mad money, he calls it.
Scanlon, I believe it's your turn, buddy.
Give me those dice. I'll blow this board to pieces. Here we go. 11-11. Count me over 11, Martini.
Why, all right.
Not that one, you crazy bastard. That's not my piece. That's my house.
It's the same color.
What's this little house doing on the electric company?
That's a power station.
Martini, those ain't the dice you're shaking.
Let 'em be. What's the difference? Those are a couple of houses.
Faw! And Martini rolls a big, let me see, a big 19.
Good going, Mark. That puts you... Where's your piece, buddy?
Huh? Well, here it is.
He had it in his mouth, McMurphy. Excellent. That's 2 moves over the second and third bicuspid, 4 moves to the board, which takes you on to Baltic Avenue, Martini, your own and only property. How fortunate can a man get, friends?
Martini has been playing 3 days and lit on his property practically every time.
Shut up and roll, Harding. It's your turn.
Harding gathers the dice up with his long fingers, feeling the smooth surfaces with his thumb as if he was blind. The fingers are the same color as the dice and look like they were carved by his other hand. The dice rattle in his hand as he shakes it. They tumble to a stop in front of McMurphy.
Four, five, six, seven. Tough luck, buddy. That's another of my vast holdings. You owe me... Oh, $200 should about cover it.
Pity. The game goes round and round to the rattle of dice and the shuffle of play money. There's long spells, 3 days, years, when you can't see a thing, know where you are only by the speaker sounding overhead like a bell buoy clanging in the fog. When I can see, the guys are usually moving around as unconcerned as though they didn't notice so much as a mist in the air. I believe the fog affects their memory some way it doesn't affect mine. Even McMurphy doesn't seem to know he's been fogged in. If he does, he makes sure not to let on that he's bothered by it. He's making sure none of the staff sees him bothered by anything. He knows that there's no better way in the world to aggravate somebody who's trying to make it hard for you than by acting like you're not bothered. He keeps up his high-class manners around the nurses and the black boys in spite of anything they might say to him, in spite of every trick they pull to get him to lose his temper. A couple of times some stupid rule gets him mad, but he just makes himself act more polite and mannerly than ever, till he begins to see how funny the whole thing is. The rules, the disapproving looks they use to enforce the rules, the ways of talking to you like you're nothing but a 3-year-old. And when he sees how funny it is, he goes to laughing, and this aggravates them to no end. He's safe as long as he can laugh, he thinks, and it works pretty fair. Just once he loses control and shows he's mad, and then it's not because of the black boys or the big nurse or something they did, but it's because of the patients and something they didn't do. It happened at one of the group meetings. He got mad at the guys for acting too cagey, too chicken shit, he called it. He'd been taking bets from all of them on the World Series coming up Friday. He'd had it in mind that they would get to watch the games on TV, even though they didn't come on during regulation TV time. During the meeting a few days before, he asks if it wouldn't be okay if they did the cleaning work at night during TV time and watched the games during the afternoon. The nurse tells him no, which is about what he expected. She tells him how the schedule has been set up for a delicately balanced reason that would be thrown into turmoil by the switch of routines. This doesn't surprise him coming from the nurse. What does surprise him is how the acutes act when he asks them what they think of the idea. Nobody says a thing. They're all sunk back out of sight in little pockets of fog. I can barely see them. Now look here, he tells them, but they don't look. He's been waiting for somebody to say something, answer his question. Nobody acts like they've heard it. Look here, damn it, he says when nobody moves. There's at least 12 of you guys I know of myself got a little personal interest who wins these games. Don't you guys care to watch them? I don't know, Mac, Scanlon finally says. I'm pretty used to seeing that 6 o'clock news. And if switching times would really mess up the schedule as bad as Miss Ratchet says, the hell with the schedule. You can get back to the bloody schedule next week when the series is over. What do you say, buddies? Let's take a vote on watching the TV during the afternoon instead of at night. All those in favor? Aye, Cheswick calls out and gets to his feet. I mean, all those in favor raise their hands. Okay, all those in favor? Cheswick's hand comes up. Some of the other guys look around to see if there's any other fools. McMurphy can't believe it. Come on now, what is this crap? I thought you guys could vote on policy and that sort of thing. Isn't that the way it is, Doc? The doctor nods without looking up. Okay then, now who wants to watch those games? Cheswick shoves his hand higher and glares around. Scanlon shakes his head and then raises his hand, keeping his elbow on the arm of the chair. And nobody else. McMurphy can't say a word. If that's settled then, the nurse says, perhaps we should get on with the meeting. Yeah, he says, slides down in his chair till the brim of his cap nearly touches his chest. Yeah, perhaps we should get on with the son of a bitchin' meeting at that. Yeah, Cheswick says, giving all the guys a hard look and sitting down. Yeah, get on with the God-blessed meeting. He nods stiffly, then settles his chin down on his chest, scowling. He's pleased to be sitting next to McMurphy, feeling brave like this, It's the first time Cheswick ever had somebody along with him on his lost causes. After the meeting, McMurphy won't say a word to any of them. He's so mad and disgusted. It's Billy Bibbit who goes up to him.
Some of us have been here for 5 years, Randall, Billy says.
He's got a magazine rolled up and is twisting at it with his hands. You can see the cigarette burns on the backs of his hands.
And some of us will be here maybe much longer, long after you're gone, long after this World Series is over. And don't you see?
He throws down the magazine and walks away.
Oh, what's the use of it anyway?
McMurphy stares after him, that puzzled frown knotting his bleached eyebrows together again. He argues for the rest of the day with some of the other guys about why they didn't vote, but they don't want to talk about it. So he seems to give up, doesn't say anything about it again till the day before the series starts. Here it is Thursday, he says, sadly shaking his head. He's sitting on one of the tables in the tub room with his feet on a chair, trying to spin his cap around one finger. Other acutes mope around the room and try not to pay any attention to him. Nobody will play poker or blackjack with him for money anymore. After the patients wouldn't vote, he got mad and skinned them so bad at cards that they're all so in debt they're scared to go any deeper. And they can't play for cigarettes because the nurse has started making the men keep their cartons on the desk in the nurse's station, where she doles them out one pack a day. Says it's for their health, but everybody knows it's to keep McMurphy from winning them all at cards. With no poker or blackjack, it's quiet in the tub room. Just the sound of the speaker drifting in from the day room. It's so quiet you can hear that guy upstairs and disturbed, climbing the wall, giving out an occasional signal.
Lou, Lou, Lou.
A bored, uninterested sound, like a baby yells to yell itself to sleep. Thursday, McMurphy says again.
Lou.
Yells that guy upstairs. That's Roller, Scanlon says, looking up at the ceiling. He don't want to pay any attention to McMurphy. Roller the squaller. He came through this ward a few years back. Wouldn't keep still to suit Miss Ratchet. You remember, Billy? Lou, 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 all the time till I thought I'd go nuts. What they should do with that whole bunch of dingbats up there is toss a couple of grenades in the dorm. They're no use to anybody. And tomorrow is Friday, McMurphy says. He won't let Scanlon change the subject.
Yeah,
Cheswick says, scowling around the room. Tomorrow is Friday. Harding turns a page of his magazine. And that will make nearly a week our friend McMurphy has been with us without succeeding in throwing over the government. Is that what you're saying, Cheswickle? Lord, to think of the chasm of apathy in which we have fallen. A shame. A pitiful shame.
The hell with that, McMurphy says. What Cheswick means is that the first series game is going to be played on TV tomorrow, and what are we going to be doing? Mopping up this damn nursery again.
Yeah, Cheswick says.
Old Mother Ratchet's therapeutic nursery.
Against the wall of the tub room, I get a feeling like a spy. The mop handle in my hands is made of metal instead of wood. Metal's a better conductor, and it's hollow. There's plenty of room inside it to hide a miniature microphone. If the big nurse is hearing this, she'll really get Cheswick. I take a hard ball of gum from my pocket and pick some fuzz off it and hold it in my mouth till it softens.
Let me see again, McMurphy says. How many of you birds will vote with me if I bring up that time switch again?
About half the acutes nod yes. A lot more than would really vote. He puts his hat back on his head and leans his chin in his hands.
I tell you, I can't figure it out. Harding, what's wrong with you for crying out loud? You afraid if you raise your hand that old buzzard will cut it off?
Harding lifts one thin eyebrow. Perhaps I am. Perhaps I am afraid she'll cut it off if I raise it.
What about you, Billy? Is that what you're scared of?
No. I don't think she did anything, but...
He shrugs and sighs and climbs up on the big panel that controls the nozzles on the shower, perches up there like a monkey.
But I just don't think a vote would do any good. Not in the long run. It's just no use, Mac.
Do any good? Ooh-wee, it'd do you birds some good just to get the exercise lift on that arm.
It's still a risk, my friend. She always has the capacity to make things worse for us. A baseball game isn't worth the risk.